Maybe yours will work too, I don't know.
It's not the same.
Maybe here, oh, we'll see.
Yeah.
Well, so you two have noted, our next speaker is from Steve Buckwall.
Yeah.
His argument of the theory of black holes.
Right.
First, you open it. You open your PDF.
No,
your PDF or your PowerPoint. And then we try something. If it works, it works. You know, it's a miracle.
If you don't want?
This is my opinion. Nobody told me how to do it, but rationally.
No, okay.
Open it completely. Nothing. Nothing.
Miracle.
Wait a minute. Miracle. Even for printing, I have to do that. You know why? I don't.
Yeah, let me plug this in too, so I won't go to sleep. Okay, so I wanted to talk a bit about the development of the theory of black holes, but not so much the early history that we just heard about, but the developments that took place mainly from the mid-1960s through about the mid-1970s. But I want to begin by commenting, that by 1939, and maybe even arguably earlier, it should have been quite clear that sufficiently massive bodies, will have to undergo gravitational collapse to black holes. And key work in this regard was in 1931. Chandrasekhar, of course, working within Newtonian gravity, established an upper mass limit for stars that are supported by electron degeneracy pressure. Oppenheimer and Volkoff looked at this issue for higher density bodies, matter at nuclear densities. They didn't necessarily have a realistic equation of state there, but what's important, in this regard, is that they analyze that within the context of general relativity, and it's really clear from the Oppenheimer and Volkoff equations that Tolman also obtained that it's much more difficult to support a star in general relativity than in Newtonian gravity. So if you're already going to have upper mass limits in Newtonian gravity, this being at lower density, of course, it's going to be much harder to do it, and I think arguably impossible to do it, even from what was known in 1939. So gravitational collapse will have to take place. And Oppenheimer and Snyder looked at the collapse of dust, getting the solution that Lemaitre had derived, as was previously explained. And although, I looked at the paper again a couple of weeks ago in preparation of this, it's not totally clear to me immediately that, the black hole structure of what you get from the collapse, but it certainly clearly stated that matter will collapse to a singularity in a finite proper time, and this matter is cut off from the outside world before it reaches the singularity, the sort of cone to get to reach the outside collapses to zero. So the basic ideas of the black hole, certainly are all here. And certainly in retrospect to me, it's absolutely astounding that this body of work, I mean, of course, there's more than just the three particular items that I cited, was really either completely ignored or explicitly shunned until, well, at least about the late 1950s. I mean, in particular, Wheeler picked up the upper mass limits and so on around then, looking at that again. And, you know, the prevailing attitude, I think, for the people who weren't just totally ignoring it is perhaps, you know, best captured with this sort of famous quote from Eddington, I mean, about the necessity of collapse and the fact that you would get gravitational collapse of black holes. So you can read this, but I mean, he regarded it as a reductio ad absurdum, and there's got to be something in some law of nature to prevent things from behaving in this absurd way. He referred to it as stellar buffoonery on another occasion or whatever. This was just dismissed out of hand. Well, I started graduate school in 1968, and gravitational collapse and black holes were of great interest, I mean, particularly at Princeton at that time. But one could clearly see very strong remnants of this attitude then. I mean, not among the people working in general relativity explicitly, but among everyone else, or most, or any people who considered them to be serious astrophysicists or physicists. And indeed, this persisted to some degree for decades. So just as explicit examples of that, aside from the small group of general relativists, black holes were taken, you know, about as seriously as, discussions of the multiverse would be taken now. I mean, you could give a talk to a group of physicists, you know, that would mention black holes or mention you'd get various combinations of wry smiles or sneers, depending on the personality of the people in the audience. When you were done, it was clear the reaction was, okay, that was fun, now we got to go back and do some actual physics. Another example is that one never until, I would say, about the mid-80s, said that some system was a black hole, it would be at best a black hole candidate or whatever. Now, of course, the observational evidence for black holes is enormously stronger now, particularly for galactic black holes, than it was then. But Cygnus X1 was just as strong a candidate for a black hole in the early 1970s as it is now. I mean, but still, people would then refer to it as a black hole candidate. As another example of this, I mean, something I'm explicitly familiar with, as I'll describe, it was, even when given, it was mostly general relativists who would give talks on black holes, but the word exotic was almost always used. I mean, it's still maybe a little bit today, but pretty much in popular lectures and so on to describe black holes. I'm aware of this because, particularly aware of this because nothing that I can think of would drive Chandrasekhar more ballistic than using the word exotic for black holes. I mean, they are gravitational collapse is a prediction of physics. Black holes are the prediction of what you should get from that. That's nature. It's not, multiverse. It's not a fantasy. So why call them exotic? or whatever. So I used to try to remember to warn speakers who speak in Chicago not to omit the word exotic, but I very often forgot, and I that's how I know that that word is still commonly used up through the early 1990s. Okay, but nevertheless, I mean, certainly by the 21st century, black holes are an absolutely important component of totally mainstream astrophysics and cosmology. I mean, you hear the word black hole in astrophysics and cosmology talks without candidate qualifications, without exotic, and all that. And of course, they're playing a central role in discussions in fundamental physics, particularly in the quest for quantum gravity. Black holes are most often invoked as a testing ground. So what I want to is not focus anymore on the sociology and so on, but describe to you the developments that took place, the key developments that took place, most of which was in this decade from the mid-1960s through the mid-1970s, that really, starting from a starting point that was not much more advanced than what Jean was just describing, to a theory where one had an incredibly, well, sophisticated and beautiful description of these black hole objects. So I want to, you know, give a brief review of what these developments were and how they occurred. So I think there's no question that the major, or certainly one of the major, but I think undoubtedly the major impetus for the development of the theory of black holes came from the discovery of quasars, as was already alluded to briefly in the morning discussion. But one had these objects that were at large redshifts. Well, originally there was a little controversy about whether it might be gravitational redshift or cosmological redshift, but it really doesn't matter. Gravity is going to be strong gravity in some sense is going to be playing a strong role, an important role in some sense. The key thing, particularly if these are cosmological, is that they required so much energy that gravitational energy, as opposed to nuclear energy, had to be their energy source. And basically, any back of the envelope calculation then would indicate that these objects must be pretty darn close to collapsing if they're not already collapsed objects, and certainly you'd have to consider general relativistic effects. The Texas Symposium, I think, was undoubtedly, I mean, for Michelle's question on history of science and so on, well, you said this was probably, has already been looked at a bit, but I think there's no question that this played an absolutely key role. And one of the outcomes, I mean, of this was getting Roger Penrose to think about these issues of gravitational collapse and in particular whether a singularity would be inevitable. And the outcome of that was a really remarkable argument in 1965 for the inevitability of singularities in conditions that must arise in collapse that's at least, you know, not too different from the picture of spherical gravitational collapse that one already had. So he introduced the notion of a trapped surface being a compact, you know, two-sphere, let's say, where both the ingoing and outgoing null geodesics converge. And then a pretty simple argument from the Rachiduri equation tells you that these null geodesics orthogonal to a trapped surface will all have to undergo caustics within a finite affine parameter. And that implies that, well, if these geodesics are inextendable, the boundary of the future of this trapped surface has to be compact. But on the other hand, if you have a non-compact Cauchy surface, as you would expect in an asymptotically flat space-time where you're studying the collapse, then a completely separate argument shows that the boundary of the future of S can't be compact. This gives a contradiction that tells you that at least one of these future-directed null geodesics has to be incomplete. That is, you have a singularity. A remarkable amount of development then of these global type arguments that form the basis of this theorem that was already there in 1965, but over about the next 7 years, there was a remarkable increase. Well, this is already, I think, quite remarkable. I mean, to have produced this as the very first thing being done in the subject, but that. But there was quite a bit of further development in that regard, which I'll get back to in a couple of minutes. A completely separate line of development also turned out to be remarkably fruitful. Well, first of all, it was only 1963 when the Kerr metrics were discovered. And they weren't discovered looking for black hole solutions or anything like that, but certainly by 1967, with Boyer and Lindquist and then Carter, it was well understood that these solutions describe black holes, a two-parameter family with angular momentum and mass. Well, in this same period, 1967, Israel proved that the Schwarzschild solution was the only static, asymptotically flat vacuum solution of Einstein's equation, that didn't have any naked singularities, that it had a regular event horizon, as was well understood by then, but no other solutions, any of the non-spherically symmetric ones, all had naked singularities. Well, it was conjectured quite soon after Israel's work that the Kerr metrics actually must be or should be the unique stationary black hole solution. So static precludes the existence of angular momentum, but if you just look for time translationally invariant black hole solutions, the conjecture was that the Kerr solutions that had just been discovered several years earlier would be the only ones. This remarkably, through a series of separate arguments, was proven by 1974, so not all that much later. But even in the late 1960s, there was considerable evidence in that behavior and for that result, and a widespread belief in its validity, which was encoded in this kind of strange phrase that Wheeler would go around saying of black holes have no hair, meaning the Kerr solutions are unique, or the Kerr-Newman solutions, if you include charge, you allow electromagnetic fields, there's a three-parameter family of solutions. So that's just the statement, those are the only stationary black hole solutions, but it was implicitly assumed in, explicitly assumed certainly by the late 1960s, but that gravitational collapse would produce a black hole, and this gave a rather startling conclusion that from the black hole end state, you can't tell anything about the black hole about it except these three parameters. So all the other hair that you might have thought you could distinguish black holes by doesn't exist. There's only these three parameters. Now, extending this further to other fields, baryons and leptons and so on, that also would imply that you can't tell how many baryons or leptons were in your collapsing star, and these laws of baryon and lepton conservation must be transcended. So those sort of ideas were very much being discussed in the air in the late 1960s. Of course, nobody proved then, and nobody has proven now, that you really do get collapse to a black hole rather than a naked singularity. And Penrose in 1969 more formally stated this, well, didn't really state it as a conjecture. I'm not sure he was particularly even believing it to be true then, but he referred to it as the cosmic sensor hypothesis that everyone else at least was making, including himself, I think, by 1969, I think, including himself, that says this result, that is, you will always get a black hole rather than a naked singularity. In the same 1969 review article where the word cosmic sensor is used, I think, for the first time, though maybe there it appears in other places from Penrose earlier, there is, I think, one of the other most major discoveries of this era in black hole physics, well, just period, I would say, of this era, which appears in a footnote of this review article, and that's the idea that energy can be extracted from a rotating black hole. Now, that's a bit startling because black holes, by definition, can only absorb things. They can't emit things, but you can get them to, even assuming, of course, that matter always has locally positive energy, because you have this region around the horizon of a rotating black hole outside of the black hole where the time translation symmetry becomes space-like, there's now, you know, defining the energy relative to these time translations, there's no obstacle now to have negative energy, and you can make the black hole swallow some of this negative energy. So you can have a particle, as it described in his footnote, you can have a particle split up into two fragments, one of which is negative and goes in, has negative energy and goes into the black hole. The other one comes out to infinity with greater mass energy than the original particle that fell into the ergo region. That isn't a tremendously efficient way of extracting energy or easy way of extracting energy from a black hole. It was soon realized that there's an easy, although not tremendously efficient, way of extracting this rotational energy of a black hole. Well, Zeldovich and Starobinsky and independently Misner realized that there would be a wave analog of the Penrose process if you send in a wave of the right frequency and angular dependence relative to the angular velocity of the horizon of the black hole, then the part of the wave that gets swallowed by the black hole will have negative energy, and therefore the reflected or wave or the wave that comes back out after it's passed near the black hole, the part of the wave, will actually have greater amplitude and energy than the original wave. Mm-hmm. Now, that, again, is not tremendously efficient way of trying to extract energy from a black hole, but you can do a lot better if you have a plasma around the black hole, in fact, a force-free plasma, and with a magnetic field as well supplied by the plausibly could be supplied by an accretion disk, you can in fact, very efficiently extract energy from a rotating black hole, and that then allows black holes to, at least as far as the energy balance and energy efficiency and so on is concerned, to be very plausibly the energy source of quasars. So that was an important development. Okay, so the final round of really important, I think, developments occurred, well, I think beginning around 1970 when Hawking took this machinery that had built up over 7 years or so to prove the singularity theorems and applied these ideas directly to prove a lot of results for black holes. And indeed, if you apply the same arguments of the Penrose singularity theorem that I described to the horizon, well, to form the horizon slightly outward, look at the boundary of its future, you have the same, if you had convergence anywhere on the horizon, you'll have the same kind of contradiction as you get in the Penrose singularity theorem, except in this case, the answer to the contradiction can't be the geodesics are incomplete because you're assuming there are no naked singularities. The only possibility is that you just don't have convergence. And that gives rise to this area theorem that the surface area of the event horizon can't decrease with time. And that fit in really nicely with the energy extraction ideas that had just been obtained, because this area increase theorem provides a limit to energy extraction, which agreed exactly with the limit that Christodoulou had calculated, considering explicitly the Penrose process with curved black holes, obtained in that particular example, exactly the monotonicity of a quantity that turns out to be the same as the surface area. So, as I say, those ideas fit in very well. Well, the final major part of the story is this rather amazing relationship between black holes and thermodynamics. So I talked about laws of baryon and lepton conservation being transcended, and Wheeler in particular was, I think, perfectly comfortable with that. But Wheeler in particular was not happy with doing the same thing to the second law of thermodynamics, which the status of second law of thermodynamics also came up in the morning discussion. But you can do the same thing there. You can take some matter, you know, a cup of tea is, I think, the example that he usually used, and with a lot of entropy, throw that into a black hole and it's gone. Depending on your point of view, in some sense you've either violated or transcended the second law of thermodynamics. Bekenstein, well, I'm not sure how exactly the suggestions developed, but there's no question that it was under some influence and possibly direct suggestions of Wheeler that Bekenstein looked into the possibility that area of black holes might be related to entropy. Now, I was a graduate student exactly contemporaneous with Bekenstein, and I remember there talking about it and hearing that that was what Bekenstein was going to do for his thesis. And I distinctly remember having a sense that I was really happy that I didn't have to work on something idiotic like that. That, first of all, there was clearly nothing to calculate, or nothing to prove, and nothing you could do anything with. And clearly the entropy didn't have anything to do with black hole area. I mean, the area increase law has, you know, derivation of that has absolutely nothing to do with second law of thermodynamics, it was clear. But I think partly stimulated by these developments, Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking then published a rather remarkable paper showing that analogs of all the laws of thermodynamics hold in classical general relativity, with the surface gravity of a black hole playing the role of temperature. But they definitely pointed out correctly that this is just a mathematical analogy, because a black hole clearly has zero temperature. You can't assign a non-zero physical temperature to a black hole. Well, that's now leads to the last step in the story that I'm giving you, because, well, Zeldovich was, I think, immediately occurred to him that this super radiant scattering, well, is analogous to stimulated emission. And in quantum physics, there ought to be then an analog of spontaneous emission, that is spontaneous particle creation. And indeed, Belenru looked at that carefully in Kerr and found exactly that effect in 1974. But of course, the analysis is being done for an eternal black hole, one not formed by gravitational collapse. Such a black hole space-time also has a white hole region, and you've got to define your initial state on the white hole horizon, and the answers depend on the choice of initial state. So in 1973, I mean, a little before the Unruh paper, in fact, was published, but you know, after Zeldovich and Starobinsky were making these claims, Austin visited Moscow and learned of their claims. I don't know what mathematical details were shown, but Hawking was skeptical of that. What he got is the brilliant insight that if you consider it a gravitational collapse space-time rather than an eternal black hole, you could avoid this issue of the initial conditions and just do a well-defined calculation. And absolutely remarkably, when he did that, he found that you got thermal emission, even, let's say, for a non-rotating black hole where this stimulated emission effect doesn't work. But due to the collapse, effectively, or due to the appropriate initial conditions that would correspond to having the collapse, you got thermal particle creation with a temperature proportional to surface gravity, and this remarkable relation between black holes and thermodynamics was now complete. That was the zero temperature was the one fly in the ointment. I mean, the analogy and so on now is not merely a perfect mathematical relationship, it seems to be a perfect physical relationship as well. So all that happened up through about 1974, and I'm looking forward during our next century of general relativity to getting a deeper understanding of some of these relationships that were and results that were obtained in the decade that I just described. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. We're a little bit behind schedule. I suppose that we convene at 5 minutes past five.
How much past 12 from now?
That's more than 20 minutes.
25 minutes from now.
I'm in the conference. I'm tired.
Something about